You got the camera, right?
The camera? You want to talk into the mic there?
Hi, Mike. Hi,
okay.
Mike.
Good. Okay, hold on. Okay. Hold on.
It's February 2nd, 2007, and we are at the Atlantic Coast Federal Bank on 8th and Center Streets in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing William Earl Shelton, Jr. He was born August 16, 1936, in Columbia, South Carolina. My name is Bobby Faust, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Gerhard Timm, who will be operating the equipment. Well, Bill, why don't we begin the interview by talking about where you were and what you were doing at the time you got your draft notice. This would have been in 1959.
Correct.
And this was a time before there was a lottery or anything like that. So what was your reaction?
There was a lottery. They didn't make me aware of it.
Oh, okay. what was your reaction to getting this draft letter, and how did it affect your life at the time?
Well, I had been out of school since I'd already obtained my college degree, so I was out of school working in New York City. I was living there with relatives. So I got this notice, and it told me where to report, which was 39 Whitehall Street in downtown Manhattan. And it was somewhat of a shock, but at the time they were drafting anyone who could stand up straight and move forward kind of thing. So I had to adhere to it because it was a letter from the United States of America, the president, if I remember correctly. And they said, you ought to report. And, of course, they give you these ridiculous hours to report at 39 Whitehall Street. It's still dark outside. It was in December of that of 59. And so I went to 39 Whitehall Street, and they processed us, gave us some equipment, gave us a physical. And then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning of the following day, they put us on a bus and sent us over to Fort Dix, which is in New Jersey. And we got to Fort Dix, and I guess we stayed there for about a week, going through the whole process, what would happen to you. And by that time, they told us they were going to ship us out. We were in the infantry, Army. They were going to ship us out to Fort Benning, Georgia, which I'd never been to. And this was also my first plane ride ever. And
let me stop you for a second. You said you had graduated college. Were you working at the time?
I was working at the time.
What were you doing?
I was working. I was a manager of about 8 restaurants in Manhattan.
Wow. So you had to quit your job?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They had no notice at all?
No.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. And then they told us that we were going to go and get our basic training the first 8 weeks at Fort Benning, Georgia. And so they shipped us out, as I said, on a plane, my first plane ride. And we got to Fort Benning, Georgia, and that's when they gave us more equipment that really fit properly, because what they give you at Fort Dix, they just, you know, make you look like a military person, and that was about it. And I stayed at Fort Benning my first 8 weeks of basic training, so I learned, you know, how to shoot a .45 caliber pistol. I learned how to shoot, I think it was an M16 rifle at the time. And
M14,
and I learned a lot of other things about how you defend yourself during that 8-week period. And then after that 8-week period, they had given, I guess I had made some kind of special test score on a test they'd given me earlier, and so they wanted to sent me off the second 8 weeks to Fort Jackson in Columbia, South Carolina, and there I stayed for another 8 weeks. And they gave me training. I became a field electrician. In other words, there I learned how to climb poles. Learned how to climb poles, you know, electric poles with electric wires on it, because anytime, you know, when you're in battle, you know, you have to have communication, and I was going to be one of those communication guys.
Well, let me go back to Fort Benning. I mean, I've never been in the military, so I've seen all these TV programs with this horrible sergeant and putting everybody through the paces. Was that your kind of experience?
Yeah, to a degree, it was, but it wasn't that difficult. You know, once you become used to it, you know that you got to get up at 4:30 or 5 a.m. in the morning. And you know, your breakfast, your lunch, and your evening meal is served at a particular time every day. The schedule doesn't change. And during the day, you're going through all of these training processes that they put you in to get you ready to be an infantry soldier. So that lasted for the 8-week period.
And while you were there, was there anybody there that made any kind of particular impression on you, or anybody that stands out that you might want to?
No, not specifically, other than my drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, you've got a good mind, a good head on you. You should stay in the military and think about becoming, you know, an officer. And that was my first time anyone had said that to me, but I had no desire to remain in the military. I was going to do, because I knew I had to do 6 years at that point in time, and that's what I was going to do.
If you became an officer, you'd have to do 6 years, yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, I would have to stay in longer.
I see.
The 6 years I'm talking about is 6 years active duty.
Ah.
And then 6 years inactive reserve, which meant that each summer for that 2-year period, I had to go to summer camp. And I was back in New York City after I got my separation papers. And so I was sent to Fort Drum in upstate New York and did my 2 weeks of summer camp there. And then after that, I had an additional 2 years, and they call that inactive reserve. And the inactive reserve, which means that I had to go downtown, there was a Army Reserve Force or something, and I had to go at least 2 weeks during the summer just to be reintroduced to the military
kind of thing.
But I had the ability to go home every day at that point in time.
Okay, so we went from Fort Benning to... What was your second 8 weeks of
training? Fort Jackson.
Fort Jackson. Okay,
right.
Tell us about that experience. Though.
Well, Fort Jackson, I learned, you know, that I was going to be, I guess they called me a wireman or something like that. And I was going to have to learn how the main focus there was training us how to climb poles. And, you know, they put these units on your boots, on your shoes, and you had gloves on and everything, and you'd go up a pole, and sometimes you'd get too close to the pole and you'd slide down, but it was in a bed of sawdust, so you know it never hurt you. So I did that for 8 weeks.
Wow.
And you know, I did they took you out on the fire range, and you still learn with the rifle again, you know, how to become even more proficient with it, that kind of thing. And when that 8-week period was finished, they shipped us by train, I believe, back to Georgia. And they shipped us to Savannah, Georgia. And in Savannah, Georgia, this was in July of 59. And we took a troop ship about, what do they call this, a battlefield unit or something like that, would normally consist of about 300 or 350 soldiers. So it was us and another battle group. Yeah, that's what they call them, battle groups. And they shipped us out to Schweinfurt, going across the
Schweinfurt,
Atlantic.
Germany.
Yeah, going across the Atlantic at that time. It was in the summer, so it was kind of nice. We could go up top and lie out and get a little sun, that kind of thing, once you finish whatever assignment they'd given you to clean up or KP or whatever. And we landed in Bremerhaven. And from Bremerhaven, we took a train, both battle groups, which is about 700 of us, if I remember correctly, to Schweinfurt. And then we were assigned to our different locations there in Schweinfurt. And that's when they separated us. That's when they found out that they wanted to know who had already finished college and had a college degree. So there were two or three of us in my battle group, and there were two or three guys also in the other battle group. So they separated us, and they put us up in the education center, which was over the building where they had the classroom. And they told us that we were going to be instructors, because this was, as I said earlier, during the Eisenhower administration, and it required that all non-commissioned officers, no matter what their status was, from E9, is that the largest?
E5.
They had to have at least a high school equivalency. So that's what I did.
So that was something new in the Army at that time, that
all non-commissioned
officers would have to have a high school equivalency.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So I taught everyone I taught was much older than myself, but they knew what they had to do, and they responded positively, and so it worked out well. But as I said, I was never staying with the unit that I came over with. I stayed above myself and my six other guys or so. We stayed in our own little rooms above the Ed Center. And the only time I had any contact with the people, the soldiers I came over with, was when we would go for meals.
So basically you were just a teacher for 2 years, or a little less than 2 years?
For about 14 months.
Yeah.
About 14 months, yeah.
So you were over in Germany for 14 months as a teacher.
As a teacher.
Yeah.
And during the day when I taught school, that was just a regular part of your military duty. And all of my cohorts, they were out in the field on bivouac. And as you know, a certain time of the year, they have a lot of snow on the ground, so they wait until the snow is pretty heavy. Then they take you out for what they call winter shield. And winter shield was when you had to go out and sort of fend for yourself kind of thing. But I never did any of that. The guys would come back and tell me how difficult or how easy it was. And when I was in college, I went to college on a basketball scholarship. So then I was able to be on the company basketball team, and so that allowed me additional freedom, because we had to have time to practice and we had to have time to go and play teams and on other posts there in Germany. I had every privilege at the time that a second or first lieutenant had. I could go to the officers' club. I never went to
the enlisted men's club.
That's right. Yeah. EM. I never had to do that. So I had very little contact with the people I went
over
with.
And what was your rank?
When I got out, when I started out, I only had one stripe of PFC, and before that, I was just a private.
Right.
Earning all of $72 a month. Mm-hmm. And then it got a little bit more when I became a private. And then about 3 months before I left Schweinfurt, and they gave me the E4, which is specialist fourth class. And in the evenings when I taught school during the week, I was paid an additional $3 an hour to do that, because it was downtime, it was my time. So I always had money in my pocket. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, when you would go to pick up your check, they would give you rations. They would give you coupons for cigarettes and coupons for other things. And I was never a smoker, so I would just wait outside and all the guys got their money for the month, and I would just sell my cigarette coupons to the highest bidder. So I always kept money in my pocket, although it was very little. But I always had money in my pocket.
Tell me what teaching was like. What kinds of things did you teach? Was it all regimented? Did you have a textbook?
Yeah, we had a textbook. I taught English and basic mathematics, mm-hmm. to these gentlemen that I had in my classroom. And they were very attentive because, as you said, if they didn't get it, you're out. And some of these guys didn't know any other way of life. They went into the military when they were teenagers. Mm-hmm. So they had no other way of generating an income or no other kind of training to make a livelihood with. They came out into civilian life. So they were very responsive to what we had to do. They were always there. They would always do their assignments. And they would come back, and I would make sure that they passed the test. No, it was a feather in my cap, and certainly a feather in their cap. And so that was nice. And as I said, I had the whole time I was there, I had weekends off. And I also played tennis while I was in college, so I made the tennis team also. So when basketball season was finished, I went over and I made the tennis team. So it was just like, I mean, it was great. It was great for me.
So tell us how you spent your weekends.
Depending on where, if I caught a flight on military, on MATS, as they called it.
What is that?
Military air transport.
Okay.
And this would give me, and I was low man on the totem pole. If there was a captain with his wife or an officer with his girlfriend or wife, they had first choice. And if there were a seat or two left, then I could get on and go for free to, and I spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks in Paris. I spent time in Denmark and Copenhagen. I spent time in, where else did I go? Those were the most part because I enjoyed Paris quite a bit, and it was easy to get around. At that point in time, I think the French really liked us. And I had friends from New York City when I was working in my job before I went into the military who were Swiss, and they were from Zurich. So I took a few on the weekends, and all you had to do to get to Zurich is to take a train. You didn't have to fly. But one thing they required, as I remember, just before you crossed the border from Germany to Zurich, they demanded that you would take off. You had to take off your uniform and be in civilian clothes because you're saying Switzerland is a neutral country.
I see.
So they said you had to bring civilian clothes and you had to wear civilian clothes while you were in any city or town in Switzerland.
Now, when you were in Paris, did you dress it in your uniform?
No, because I didn't want anyone to know. I was trying to be a non-ugly American, if you will. And I'd go to the cheapest hotel, and then I really enjoyed myself.
Did you speak French?
At the time, just very little.
So they did know you were American. I'm just curious as the reaction of Europeans to the American presence at the time. I mean, you know, this was big NATO.
Well, the thing is, at least if you tried to speak their language, they would help you. Mm-hmm. If you just wanted to stick to speaking English, and as you know, or as you may or may not know, you know, the French are very proud people, and if you tried, they would help you. It would help you.
Did you find though that the Europeans were happy to have the presence of Americans there? I mean, because we are in the middle of the Cold War and
right during that period, absolutely, I had no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we were stationed in Schweinfurt, and the people, the Germans, they had treated us well. In fact, I remember I spent one or two Christmases, I can't remember, and because of my working in the Army Education Center, I had German families who would select a military guy, and they would invite us to their homes for Christmas. And the Germans, they opened their Christmas gifts on Christmas Eve evening as opposed to Christmas Day. So that was very nice because they cooked a fabulous meal, and they had two young daughters, and both of them were musically inclined. One sang and one played the piano, so we'd just sit there and really enjoyed ourselves, and they would take me back on base, and I had no particular curfew time that I had to, you know, be on base at midnight or whatever. I could get there any time I wanted to. Only thing I had to know is that I had to teach the following day or something like that. Yeah.
While you were in Germany for 14 months, is there any particularly memorable experience or memorable person that you might want to talk about?
I had two young lieutenants, second lieutenants, who had just, I guess they'd gone to school somewhere and they were commissioned as lieutenants. And they became my best friends because I hung out with them all the time. I can't remember their names now, but they were my two best friends other than the people that worked with me in the Army Ed Center because I could go wherever they could go and that kind of thing. And they always came to our basketball games and things of that nature. So it was enjoyable to be around them. And I must say, both these guys were from the South and both were white, but it never, ever occurred to me or occurred to them that we were people of different color. I mean, they You know, they would invite me to their homes for meals. And I mean, we just had a great time with those guys.
I was going to ask you, as an African-American in the Army, which had only recently been integrated, did you yourself experience any racism, or did you witness any? Or was the Army really progressing fairly well?
The Army was really progressing, but I do remember when we would go off base and go downtown into Schweinfurt, there were only certain restaurants that the African-American soldiers would go to, and that the white soldiers would go to different ones. And I don't know why that was. Maybe it was because the owners, you know, sort of set it up that way. I don't know. But other than that, no.
It's interesting because, I guess, as I was saying before, with an autocratic kind of structure, it's much easier to accomplish a goal than it is in a democratic society.
The gentleman, the soldier who was captain of my particular, I forget what the word is, my division or whatever it's called, he was from the South. But he always wanted to make sure that everything was okay with me because he never saw me that much. And he'd come over to see me at the Army, at the Ed Center, that kind of thing. And he was a big basketball fan, so he'd come to the basketball games and everything. And we had a pretty decent team. So, no, I mean, he, I remember, I can't remember his name now. But I think he went through OCS school someplace. He may have been in the military, and maybe he got his bars going to OCS school. Mm-hmm. But
from your experience in the Army,
mm-hmm.
did that have any impact on your thinking about the military in general?
Well. Negative and positive. Negative being I wanted to get out because I wanted to get on with my civilian career. On the positive end, I had a very positive experience. I never went out on bivouac, but I remember at that point in time, there was an East and a West Germany, and I remember some of my buddies who were out on bivouac, or they had to go through, they were on call or on duty, and they had to walk the fence between East and West Germany, and they always said that, I don't know why we had war with these guys, you know. If they need cigarettes, I give them cigarettes. If they have candy bars, if I can get a pair of nylons for their spouse, I would do it, and that was it. And while we were on duty, I think it was on 6 or on 8 or something like that, we would walk the line to a certain location, and then we'd stop and walk back. And they were, you know, friendly. They could never figure out why we were at war or potentially at war. Yeah. And these were East Germans, not Russians, why we had war with the East Germans and that kind of thing. And the other thing that's interesting, too, we lived on a base that was formerly a German soldier base. And, I mean, just magnificent buildings. I mean, hardwood floors, stone buildings, I mean, you know, really great quarters that they put up, that they put the guys up in. And most of the people who were there as civilian employees were Germans from Schweinfurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, it was my 13 or 14 months in Germany was sweet. I had a membership to a tennis club that cost me all of, I don't know, $15 or something for the summer. They had a spa downtown.
Wow.
I could go to a spa, and for $5 or $6, I could stay there all day. And I mean, I have nothing to say. I didn't want to stay, but I had absolutely nothing to say negative, really.
I think you indirectly answered the other question. You read in the textbooks about the Cold War and how tense life was at the time, but here you were right there on the border, and it didn't seem like there was much feeling of tension at all.
Not with the infantrymen who walked that line and walked that fence, no.
Isn't that's very interesting. Is there anything else you want to add about your military experience before we talk about more present-day things?
No, I think that is. It was a good... Oh, the only thing is allowed us to come back. I was scheduled to come back in January of 1961, but they did what they called Operation Santa Claus. So they put us on a troop ship and sent us back across the Atlantic in like mid-December. And we ended up
closer
to Charleston, South Carolina, because they were going to send us back to where we came from, and we were going back, and we were going to be separated in Brooklyn, at the Brooklyn, whatever it's called, military yard or whatever it was called. And so that, instead of being a normal 10-day trip across the Atlantic, that ended up about 13 or 14 days because we were totally off course. And, of course, during that period, you couldn't go up top because the seas in that time of the year, it was cold and it was rough.
Right.
So that's the only other thing I remember about my military. But
I know that you had a career in sports management.
Right.
And, what ever brought you to Amelia Island, and when did you get here?
Whatever brought me to Amelia Island. When the plantation first opened, I mean, I think it was either 71 or 72, something like that. Yeah. And I was working for Nick Bollettieri at the time, and I was working in his office.
Who's Nick Bollettieri? I'm sorry.
He's a teaching pro. He's a very famous teaching pro, and I'll tell you a little bit more about him. But Nick had a company called All American Sports, and I had begun to work for him, so we had a reputation for setting up new tennis facilities and supplying them with the pro shop, getting all of the merchandise there, and supplying them with teaching pros and that kind of thing. So I knew about Amelia Island early on. At that point, it was nowhere near what it is now. The hotel was only, the one you see there now, was only about four stories high, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And we came down as employees of All American Sports and set up the tennis pro shop and hired all of the personnel to run the tennis facility at the plantation. And then I continued in my career doing different things, and I finally got around to leaving Nick and then began to work for a company called Advantage International in Washington, D.C. And as you can see between that, I worked for Prince. I had a lot of different jobs in tennis. And I began to represent and work with Zena Garrison.
Oh.
And Zena had come to the plantation to play in the Bausch & Lomb on several occasions. I forget, one year she won the Bausch & Lomb. So I became reacquainted with the plantation and with Amelia Island. So I knew a little bit about the plantation or Amelia Island before my wife and I decided to move from Alexandria, Virginia. Raven didn't, but I did. And
Raven's your wife.
Right. So that's how we got here. We didn't want to go to as far south as Miami or any place like that. And so we finally looked. I guess the first place we looked was St. Augustine. We thought about St. Augustine. We thought about Daytona Beach. And then we got a good real estate agent here in the area, so we settled here.
And what year was this? About how long ago was it?
Almost 3 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, almost 3 years ago.
And I know Raven has her own business now, and
yeah,
still are in sports management.
Right, still doing some promotional kinds of things, and still have an excellent relationship with the plantation and the gentleman who is vice president of marketing over there, trying to do some different kinds of things with him. In fact, one of the things that I'm trying to do for this coming Labor Day weekend, I have a contact with Wynton Marcellus, so if I can raise the necessary sponsorship dollars, we'll have him at the plantation.
Mm.
But that's still got to raise the sponsorship money to do that, because he doesn't come cheap. But it would be nice. Everyone I've talked to here on the island about Wynton Marcellus, they love it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I wanted to add for the record that Mr. Shelton also provided us with his resume, so that should be incorporated into his record so you can see at what point he was here and what point he changed careers and changed jobs and worked for the different companies.
Right.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to add, or Gerhard, is there any questions that you have?
I can just add on by saying that since we've been here, I mean, we love this part of Florida. I mean, it has been a real treat for us. Raven has been able to do much better here in her profession than we would have ever. I mean, we were in Alexandria, Virginia for about 20 or 22 years. But here we were able to find a building and put her in it and let her do what she loves doing best, because I don't know if you know her background, but she's did 8 Broadway shows and that kind of thing. So she's a very creative kind mm-hmm. of person. So she still loves doing that.
I know she why don't you tell me a little about what she does now?
What she does now. Well, her company is called Image and Style. So it's makeover. She does fashion shows. She does a lot of different things over there.
Yeah, I know she's very involved with the community, and
yeah,
she does a lot of work for
her. In fact, she's doing a reading at the library mm. soon, and this will be her second time doing that. And, of course, for the last 2 years, we participated in the Shrimp Festival Parade. It's just kind of interesting. I never thought I'd be in a town where a festival parade for shrimp would be a huge deal, but it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal.
It is, yeah.
And so all of that is kind of nice, and we live in a nice little community. And no one that very few people that I met are from here.
Right.
Everybody is retired and from someplace else. So that's also kind of interesting, because you get to talk about different things, people who've been there, done that kind of thing, and it's really interesting. It's a unique place. It really is.
It is. This really is a special place.
A very unique
I think we
place.
All love it. Okay, well, that concludes our interview with William Earl Shelton, Jr., and we want to thank you for sharing your recollections for the benefit of our nation. Thank you very much.